Hey, nonfiction branders, it's me, DP Knutton, at the Nonfiction Brand Podcast, Culture Brand Edition with
Leah Rowe.
We are here to talk about the collision, the intersection, the conjoined twins of culture and brand. Because from my point of view, they really are. And it all comes down to the difference between saying and doing. Brands say, culture does. As we go through this over the podcast, you're going to hear examples. We're going to flesh out that idea a lot further. But for now, we just want to talk about all the things that kind of exist within that intersection between two incredibly important things for any business, that is culture and brand. But enough of me talking. I want to say hi to Leah Rowe.
Hi. DP, as you were just talking now, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What do you think comes first, the brand or the culture?
Well, that's funny, Leah Rowe, because as you know, boy, thanks for teeing up that golf ball.
Well, I haven't heard you say it in a long time, so I want to hear it.
Yeah, well, good. She's referring to the fact that I do a presentation called Culture Chicken, Brand Egg, Which Comes First? And it's a really fun presentation that a lot of people have responded to in a very positive way, because it talks about the idea of, do you have to have a culture before you can have a brand, or can you have a brand before you have a culture? And I hate to give you a spoiler that's kind of lacking satisfaction, but the answer is yes, you can have either first as long as the other comes immediately after. And the examples I like to use are brand first. The United States of America was a brand first entity. Everything that our culture is based on is based upon the founding documents of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. And it's so important that we have the Supreme Court of the United States of America to adjudicate our brand correctness. The Supreme Court is our brand police, if you will. On the other hand, culture can come first, and the example I like to use is REI, Recreational Equipment Incorporated. It's a wonderful membership-style organization that has retail stores and online catalogs and e-commerce all over the place for people who need equipment to enjoy the outdoors. That culture was started well in advance of what we know today as a retail store called REI. I'm not going to go too far into that other than to say, yes, you can start with culture. Yes, you can start with brand. But either way, you better follow up with the other.
Here's an interesting question or thought. As I'm thinking about in terms of, you know, the company that I work for, it's possible that we actually were building a brand and a culture at the same time, but in silos. Because I'm thinking about, you know, our marketing department, I feel like was focusing on building a brand, you know, building out, again, just brand-like stuff, logos, colors, you know, how our voice out to the world, to our customers and everything. And then me and my team in the people ops department, we were building the culture and, you know, how we voice things internally. What are your thoughts on that, of building in silos and then like having to like bring those two together once you go to a fantastic talk like DP's and realize, oh my gosh, brand and culture need to really, you know, line up with each other.
Well, you're setting me up again for the
really?
You are.
I'm not doing this on purpose.
No, but it's really good, because it goes into what's the difference between a garden variety brand and a nonfiction brand. A nonfiction brand is based not on what you think you want to be, but who you actually are. Now, it can have some aspects of it that are aspirational. Ideally, you want to be yourself, but 25% better, or maybe even 50% better, but you're still yourself. In the case of a startup, and keep in mind, HealthFinch is still technically kind of a startup-y, right? You got to go to the marketplace with packaging. And when I say packaging, I mean things like a logo, color, type, fonts, a certain amount of boilerplate language that is continually used. Mm-hmm. You want your PowerPoint presentations to all match depending on who's selling to whom.
Sure.
You want to be able to communicate what those things are. And so you have to develop the brand foundation, the written documents, the graphic standards manual, all these things, so that you've got some cohesion there, right? Because otherwise we've got people going all sorts of different ways visually and even in terms of the way they talk about the business. So a brand is great at saying, this is what we're saying, this is what we look like. A nonfiction brand starts with, this is who we are. this is why we look like this. This is why we sound like this. This is why we do things the way we do. So in the case of Health Finch, you're discovering what a lot of companies do, which is the right hand is doing the branding. Mm-hmm. The left hand is building a culture. And sooner or later, you figure out that, boy, we should really be shaking hands here and creating something that the distance between your brand and your culture is the width of a coin. Literally, one side is culture, the other side is brand. And that's kind of what this podcast is all about, is trying to get people to understand that the difference between brand and culture comes down to the difference between saying and doing. A brand will say, these are our colors. This is what we stand for. This is the way we address the marketplace. A culture will say, this is how we do. This is how we interpret our brand.
Do you think, so brand and culture then should be felt throughout the company? So from recruiting people into the company to selling to customers, so your customers and potential employees and the world should feel and know your culture and your brand. Is that?
Oh, absolutely. Because, well, ideally, a brand is a prism or a lens that allows you to select the right people to join your culture. A lot of companies have the no fill in the blank holes rule, right? We don't want to hire any jerks. Mm-hmm. Great. Why? Well, because that would hurt our culture. You know, one of the metaphors that I've heard used and I like to use a lot myself is, have you ever had an aquarium where you add a new fish and it kills all the rest of the fish? Literally, the change of one fish within that aquarium could destroy the entire culture of that aquarium. That's true of companies that hire the wrong person for all the right reasons. An example is, companies will often do this. They see a downturn in sales. Oh, I need to bring in a real killer rainmaker. Get that guy who's an incredible salesperson. And that person comes in and they know how to sell all day long. And they can have incredible numbers, incredible engagement, incredible new relationships created with customers. And yet the way he or she does it is so toxic to the entire environment that everything else starts to suffer. Now, when I do my talk, I'll often ask the people in the audience, have you ever been in an organization that fired a top performer because of the way they were that top performer? And inevitably, hands are going up or heads are nodding because they've seen it, mm-hmm. which is our culture is more valuable than the brief bump in sales that we will see.
Totally. And I think, you know, hiring people like that, we talk about, there's so many different definitions of culture out there, but one that I do really like is that your culture will be built by the worst behavior that you tolerate at your organization. So as a CEO, as an executive team, whatever the worst behavior you allow to persist, that's going to ultimately dictate your culture, which I think is very true in terms of like what you were just talking about. And I think it's also really interesting because I've worked at companies in the past where I've seen the CEO and executive leadership make a really tough call and fire somebody who's in, you know, the leadership, who's on the leadership team because they were building a toxic culture. They had behaviors that were toxic to the organization. And when I see that happen, I feel so much more committed and loyal to the company and to the CEO when I see that they've made the tough decision of choosing the culture and the future of the company and their people over somebody who could be their number two. But what I also think is really interesting about that is I know what happened because I'm in people ops, which also includes HR. So I know that. But the rest of the company doesn't know why that person left.
Because I would argue, well, obviously there are all sorts of privacy concerns, sure, and things like that. But I would argue that that is a fantastic time for the brand to get out there and communicate the why this happened.
Yeah. But that can be really difficult if, for example, you're working with a legal team, which in situations like this, you usually do, and agreements are written that, you know, neither one of you can say what happened, which is something that I've struggled with in past roles of, you know, really being like, I want to tell the company, you know, this great thing that our CEO did and like, This shows that he or she cares so much about the culture and chooses the culture and you all over this person.
Well, I'm sitting here going, yes, you can. Not in a way that gets the legal eagles on your butt, mm-hmm. but in a way that communicates the truth without the details of the situation.
Yeah, because I mean, that reinforces our brand and who we are. But if you can't communicate your brand and who you are. Does it exist?
I'm not sure what company did this, but a high-level executive, I think it was even C-level executive, had been throwing around a nuclear bomb of a word very casually in conversation several times, and he was fired because of it. I think it would be very easy to Google and figure out what who the company was and the way they handled it. But they actually explained it and said, this type of language is unacceptable. The person's name wasn't mentioned. The words that were used were not mentioned. You can read between the lines all day long. And I understand that a lot of companies want to circle the wagons when something like that happens and just don't say anything. Nature abhors a vacuum. That vacuum will be filled typically with disinformation. I like to think in metaphors and analogy a little too much, as everyone who knows me knows, but I like to explain it in terms that are, again, very simplistic. But you got mom and dad who know the budget, who know how much you can afford, and you got the kids. Mom and dad are looking at where can we afford to go on vacation? And the money might be too tight to go anywhere on vacation. So what do we do? Worst thing mom and dad can do is not communicate to the kids, because the kids are watching their friends go to Disney World and, you know, summer camp or Europe or all this stuff. And they're kind of in this vacuum of, where do we get to go? Ideally, this is an opportunity for mom and dad to sit down and say, family meeting. We're having a family meeting. And guess what? We're talking about what we're going to do for summer vacation this year. We have something really cool planned. We're going to stay at home, but we're going to go to all the... And you explain the why. Mm-hmm. Money's a little bit tight, but we're still going to have a lot of fun. And we're going to do all the stuff around town that we never get to do. So on Monday, we're going to go here. You know, and they've already charted out how much everything costs, so they know they can do it. And all of a sudden, the kids understand, oh, money's tight, but we still get to have fun. That's cool.
I totally agree. I mean, you have to explain and communicate why things are happening, why you're doing the things that you're doing with everyone at the company. And I think that's, you know, that's a huge trend that we've seen over the past, I don't know, decades now, of defaulting to transparency and being transparent with your employees and with the company. But I see a lot of companies that struggle with that of, you know, some companies are extremely transparent. They share everyone's salaries. Other companies, they struggle to know what information to share and what not to share. And usually what I've seen is that it's well-intentioned. They're nervous to share too much information because they don't want to scare their employees or they don't want to upset them. But what I've also seen is that when those CEOs and those leadership teams do share the information that they're scared to share, there's a rallying in the company. You know, everyone gets behind them. And like in your budget example, you know, that's when the kids come out and say, well, if we're tight on money, you know, I've been doing this and I'll contribute some of my money so that we can go to this water park or what have you. But I definitely think that that's something that each company struggles with a little bit and needs to be intentional and make a decision around of how transparent are you with your people.
Well, and understand that not making a decision is a decision.
Absolutely. And choosing to do nothing is absolutely a stance that you take.
Well, and it's also indicative of your culture.
Oh, yes.
Part of our culture is when something difficult arises, we choose to do nothing. As opposed to our culture says we confront it directly, we rally the team, we communicate clearly, we overcome it in a way that is sustainable and scalable for our business. Because keep in mind, solving a problem by throwing money at it and that money then craters your company, that's not a good solution. It has to be something that sustains and scales so that you can have a company that allows all the families that depend on that company to continue to depend on that company.
I think what you just said was spot on. And I think it's important, too, to have someone at your company that's almost being a watchdog, if you will, for those opportunities where we need to address this. And if we don't address this and we don't address it fast, then we're taking the stance of we're not going to do anything or say anything. And that really speaks to our employees and our people who we are. And is that really who we want to be? I say a lot, you know, and at HealthFinch, I really take that position. I say a lot that I'm, you know, I'm like the internal PR department, because I'll sit back and I'll watch things that are said or things that are done. And I'll notify our CEO like, hey, we need to address this and we need to address this now. And we work together to figure out the best way to do that. But I think it's important for companies to have somebody who kind of has that intuition or gut of just being able to sit back and observe and really see when they need to step in and say something.
This episode of the Nonfiction Brand Podcast is brought to you by Nonfiction Brandversity. It's a free Facebook group dedicated to the art and craft of personal branding. And we'd like to invite you. Just search Nonfiction Brandversity on Facebook and ask to join. You're in, guaranteed. I can't wait to see you on campus. Well, let's talk about that for a second, because the grassroots of a company, you know, the people who are in the trenches every day, they can want the culture to be whatever they want. If the person up top doesn't agree, doesn't support, doesn't encourage, doesn't enforce, where's that culture going to go?
It's not going to go well. You know, a few years ago, I would have said everyone at a company can be an equal part in building a culture. And I've totally changed my tune on that. The CEO, the top person at that company, it is crucial for them to play an active role in building the culture at every company.
Culture can be an organizing principle. Literally, and keep in mind, the thing about principle, you only get one, right? Your organizing principle is make money. Okay, that's an organizing principle. An organizing principle is shareholder value. We've seen that and what that can do. Or the principle can be a culture that supports people. That has to be a C-level decision that is not forced on the CEO, whoever's the person in charge, but actually comes from, they are the wellspring of that in everything they do.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to note that if you're a CEO at a company or you want to be a CEO, you don't have to be a culture expert. Like, you can surround yourself with people that will help support and help to build the culture that you believe is right for the organization. Because I think that's a lot of pressure to put on somebody that, like, you need to know from the get-go what kind of culture to build, and you need to know how to do it, and you need to be able to do it all on your own. Because it's almost like a checks and balances thing. So, and I think that's part of what my job is at HealthBench, is to help support my CEO in the vision he has for the company, and to be able to let him know what I see going on and what we need to do to continue to build the culture that we all agree is right for the company. The greatest CEOs are the ones that recognize their own strengths and weaknesses and surround themselves with people who are strong in areas where they're weak, and then they trust them. You know, it'd be one thing if my CEO is like, you know what, I'm not super great at the people ops stuff, at all of that. So I'm going to hire Leah to come in and help. But ultimately, I'm just checking off a box that I have like a people ops department. So it's really surrounding yourself with people that counterbalance your weaknesses, but then also trusting them and listening to them and taking action on what they're saying.
Well, and again, this podcast is about the intersection between culture and brand. The brand part of it can lay the foundation upon which culture can thrive, but that culture and that brand needs to come not from the grassroots. It might be instigated by grassroots desire, but it has to be totally embraced by everybody at the very highest level and then enforced all the way down. And sometimes that enforcement will come in the form of, you know what? You're not right to be the director of this because you don't subscribe to this culture or to what our brand foundation is.
How important do you think it is then for the CEO to behave and to live in terms of the brand and the culture of the company? And what happens when they step out of line?
I think that is a teaching opportunity. That is a learning opportunity. Well, the bottom line is, again, nonfiction branding versus typical branding. Branding can be packaging, or it can be an entire governing philosophy that includes things like branding and graphic standards and stuff like that. But if there is that big a disconnect between the CEO and what the brand stands for, that's a real big problem, whose solution can be very varied. Companies die because of that. CEOs lose their jobs because of that. The board steps in and takes over because of that. If a CEO is so unaligned with the core values, the core brand, the core culture of the company, that's a hurricane coming.
Well, I think, you know, it's easy when you have employees that misalign with the brand or misalign with the culture. It's easier to take care of that problem. When it's your CEO, I mean, luckily, I've never personally been in that situation, but I can't imagine the damage control and like how you'd move the company forward. Because when the CEO starts behaving out of line with your values, with culture, with your brand. But I guess it's a good question too of what if a CEO makes a mistake? Do they have, should they have the opportunity to make up for that?
Making a mistake implies a one-time event. However, is that mistake indicative of that person's core being, their true self? There's a difference between a bus driver making the wrong turn and a bus driver being drunk. If the bus driver is drunk, be smart, get off the bus.
And I think it brings up a good question too of what do you do when you get to a company or a new CEO comes in and you don't agree with how they behave, you don't agree with the culture they're building, you don't agree with the brand they're building, but you love your coworkers and you feel like, you know, you can grassroots it. Like we can make change here. You know, how hard would you work to do that if the CEO doesn't seem aligned?
And this goes back to an earlier conversation we had in a podcast. I've always tried to create subcultures that were mutually supportive, that were high performing, that were the type of place that people always wanted to work because they like everybody and they are doing what they do at their best possible level. You know, they're performing as good as they can. And as a leader of that subculture, I was kind of shielding as much as I could the torrent of crap that was coming down from above. I'm here to tell you that it's really hard for a subculture to become a majority of the culture and then to take over the culture. Who was it? Was it Pete Drucker or Tom Peters? I can't remember which. I think it was Pete Drucker who said it's easier to create a new culture than change an existing one.
Totally.
Well, that's an example right there, which is a subculture within a toxic culture, trying to take over that toxic culture. Good luck with that.
You know what I think is interesting about that too, and something that I think about a lot is when you have these subcultures within a company, which again, I think is a totally fine thing, but ultimately what I've seen in my experience is the people in different departments become very loyal to the leader of that department. So then you have this risk of, man, if this leader leaves, we lose that entire department because they're loyal to that leader. They're not loyal to the company, which I think is an interesting thing to think about. Is that okay? Are we okay with the fact that an entire department is loyal to the leader as opposed to the company as a whole?
Well, that's a cultural decision that everybody makes. I personally will always be more loyal to people than entities. And keep in mind, a company is an entity made up of people. I've been in positions where people have left and I've followed them right out the door to another place. I've been at places where I was the person who was shuttled out the door. And within 3 months, my entire team found their way out the door one at a time.
So if you were the CEO of a company, would you be okay with having your departments built and your leaders engaging their employees in a way that builds loyalty to them over loyalty to you? And so then if you get in a difficult situation with one of your top management and you have to get rid of them, you're okay with that whole department leaving?
I would prefer to have a culture that says, we all agree on this. This is the most important thing. This is our organizing principle. This is the way we are going to run. Be loyal to that, not some structure.
Sure.
Structures develop because companies need effective ways to organize so that they can do what they say. Mm-hmm. And again, this brand culture divide here is not really a divide, but two sides of the same coin. Creating a culture where people can be loyal to each other. And by being loyal to each other, they are being loyal to the company. That's the goal. There are people who are structuralists who believe in the power of structure and the importance in their life. I don't subscribe to this philosophy at all, but I've seen it where people are like, yeah, I know I'm at the bottom of the totem pole and I have to eat a lot of crap sandwiches, but I'm eventually going to rise, and then one day, I'll be the one making the crap sandwiches.
That's public accounting in a nutshell, which is why I'm a recovering CPA.
Oh my gosh. Well, that might be a good place for us to end this podcast, because that's a whole nother can of worms. With that said, I'd like to ask Leah the question I love to ask, which is, what's on your radar when it comes to cool stuff that our listeners might want to know about?
I've really been thinking about how to take an inbound marketing strategy and apply it to recruiting employees. So I don't know if you've read the book, They Ask, You Answer by Marcus Sheridan. So in that book, he just talks about putting out content to pull people in, to pull qualified leads in for sales, But I'm taking that and really thinking of how we can do that at HealthBench and apply it to recruiting employees into us. What sort of content can we push out to continuously pull qualified candidates into our company?
I've been fortunate enough to see Marcus Sheridan speak, and that guy is just a powerhouse of information. And typically it's in the kind of sales universe. But really what he's saying is exactly what you're talking about, which is everybody needs to attract new customers, new employees, retain customers and employees.
Totally.
And he's got a ton of great ideas. Go on YouTube, type in the words Marcus Sheridan. You're going to see a ton of his video content. You know, I haven't read the book, but I've seen the guy and he's legit.
Yeah. And what you talk about, you know, he focuses on sales. Very much what we're doing in recruiting is selling. I think that the world has changed where it's not just the employees coming in and selling us on their resume. We really have to sell them on our company too and make sure it's a place that they want to buy into and that we want to buy into them. So I'm just totally, I've been totally jazzed by just thinking about this inbound content marketing strategy for employee recruitment, not just for sales.
Well, and as of today, I think it's what, 2.2 unemployment in the state of Wisconsin? Mm-hmm. Every company who wants to attract people has got to tell their story in an effective way that attracts people. So this is a employee's market. And the way you get those employees to become associates of your business is by telling your story, really communicating your culture, and I would add, in a way that is supported by your nonfiction brand, because that's what's going to attract, engage, and retain. All right, we're at the end of another Nonfiction Brand Culture Brand Edition podcast, and I want to say thanks for listening. And from me, DP Knutton,
and Leah Rowe,
we hope you'll be listening next time.